I'm delighted that you're here this morning, and you'll forgive me of being a bit under the weather. I think it's more mainly me mixing medicines. I've had this thing that I think many of you have had, and I took Mucinex this morning, and I can't swallow, so I chew it, right? So I get it all in like 30 minutes, and it unsettles me, but I know, you know, that's just part of it. And so I took that, and then I got to the church, and so I'm unsettled, and I think I have a headache. So Anita gives me what she said was Tylenol now. I don't know that that was the case, but anyway, I chewed it, and I went over to the kids' class, Stacy and Chad in Scores class, and sit down, and 3 minutes later, I'm unbuttoning my coat and loosening my tie, and I'm on fire from head to head to toe. I mean, I'm just burning, and so I thought, oh, wow. I came over, and so my tie got lost and all that. That's happened, but in any case, I feel good now, but I need something to hold on to. So I want to read one verse to you from Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, and just talk to you about it in our time together. Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. One of the problems with names, at least for us, is that names don't mean a lot. In our culture and in other cultures, names are chosen because, for instance, we like the way that it sounds, or we like the rhythm of the name. And so Richard Buse, who is a missionary, spent a lot of time in various places, says that in New Guinea, that he met a young boy, and in New Guinea, he says that they like to name children after they like to give them English words for their names, but they don't know what the words mean. They just like the sound of the word. So he met a young boy named Tuna Fish, and he met his sister named Second Gear. And he said then he was in Kenya, and he met a young boy named Oxford University Press. And so they give them names that they like the sound of. And to some degree, maybe we do that as well. And, you know, we have a rich Aunt Agnes, and so we name our kid Agnes in hopes that maybe she'll inherit, or we like the initials on the luggage, or we like the rhythm, or it's after our favorite movie star. And so oftentimes our names don't mean a lot. But the Jewish people, and particularly the Near Eastern people, and I think they get it from God, names were crucial. Names were given in hopes that the child would live up to that name, or in fact become that name. They were very much like the Puritans of our country, where Puritan would name their children words like hope and love and charity and silence. Hopes that their kids would live up to those names. Well, the Jewish people did that. In fact, the name was so important that if a person was given a name, but then they changed radically, that their name was changed. And so in the Bible, we see Jesus meeting a man named Cephas. And Cephas was a shifty kind of guy, sort of a shaky kind of guy. But Jesus came along Cephas, and he changed his life. And he said, Cephas, you will become a rock. You will become granite. And he changed his name to Peter. So names are very, very important. And so given the text here, it says that a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and call his name Emmanuel. And then Matthew chapter 1, verse 25, this prophecy is assigned to Jesus. What does it mean to call a child Emmanuel? What does Emmanuel mean? And it's very simple. It means God with us. God with us. And in our time together, I just want to break that down. God God with and God with us. First of all, Jesus was named because he was God. He was named Emmanuel, God with us. That is screened throughout the scriptures, and that's why Christians get really bent out of shape when people come along and say, listen, we all sort of worship the same God, and let's all join together and sing Kumbaya to the great spirit in the sky. We say, no, Jesus was God. God has a name. His name is Jesus. And Jesus is the expression of God. He is God in all of his fullness. And Jesus Christ, the unreal became real. The impossible became possible. The supernatural became natural. The metaphysical became physical. In Jesus Christ, we have God in the flesh. And so we worship him as that. And that's spoken of explicitly and implicitly throughout scripture. Explicitly, Jesus, we are told in 1 John, for instance, that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and we know that the Word later on is explicitly Jesus. Jesus was with God, and he was God. In John chapter 8, where Jesus says, before Abraham was born. Abraham was born in Jesus' time, 2,000-3,000 years before. He said, but before Abraham was born, I am. And that's latching on to the burning bush language in Genesis chapter 3, where God introduced himself as the I am. And so Jesus is saying, I am, I was predated Abraham, and I am the I am. John chapter 10, Jesus says, the Father and I are one. Father and I are one. John chapter 14, Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me, but by me. Then John chapter 20, Thomas kneels down before Jesus and says, my Lord and my God. You know what? Jesus doesn't correct him, because what Thomas said was absolutely correct. He was Lord and he was God. Explicitly, it's throughout the scripture. Implicitly, it's throughout the scriptures. So we're told that Jesus forgives sins, right? And only God can forgive sins. And when he forgave sins, the Jews came along and said, blasphemy. And they were absolutely right. If he wasn't God, it was blasphemy. But he was God. He had the right to forgive and absolve of sin. We find throughout the Bible that he allows himself to be worshipped, which the angels never did. Anytime someone kneeled down before an angel, the angel said, get up. I'm a created being like you are. You shouldn't be worshiping me. But 8 times in the book of Mark, Jesus allows himself to be worshiped. And then Thomas again in John 20 kneels down and worships him. You have the Matthew chapter 25, verse 31 through 46 passage where Jesus says that he will come and he will judge the world. Only God can do that. But Jesus says, when the Son of Man comes, and he calls himself frequently the Son of Man, he says, when I come, I will judge the world. And we have, if that's not enough, we have the resurrection. He was God, explicitly, implicitly. I think maybe the greatest evidence that he was God was that his disciples and his followers believed him to be God. I mean, think about it. The disciples were Jews, first of all. And for a Jewish person, believing that God would come in the flesh was a really hard sell. It was a brutal sell. If they were Greeks, that would have been different. The Greeks believed in avatars. They believed that gods could come in and inhabit human bodies. In fact, when Paul and Barnabas are in a certain town, I believe Lystra, in Acts chapter 14, they do some miracles, and the residents come and say, oh, you're Zeus and Hermes. And it's like, you're the gods. And then later on, Paul gets snake bit and he shakes it off, and the Greeks are there and they say, oh, you're a god. It wasn't hard for the Greeks to believe that people could be gods, but the Jews could not believe that for any number of reasons. But yet the disciples who are Jews came to believe that Jesus was God. It was a tough sell for them. not only was it a tough sell because of where they came from, but it was a tough sell because they had to live with him. I mean, listen, if you want to convince somebody you're God, it's a lot easier to convince people that don't live with you that you're God, right? I mean, the people who have to live with you, they're not the ones who think you're God. And a lot of people think Elvis is alive and that Elvis was some kind of God. Priscilla Presley doesn't think Elvis was God. And those people who had to live with him thought that he was God. Remember the old joke, a worn out joke about the guy who's in divorce court and he's there and his wife's on the other side and the judge asked him the cause of the divorce and he said, religious differences, she didn't believe I was God. See? When people have to live with you, they don't believe you're God. It's the people who don't see you and all of your humanity that can believe that you're something really, really special. But the people who have to live with you see your humanness, and they're the ones that are tough to convince. But these are people who not only were Jewish, but they were people who had to live with Jesus. And they staked their lives that he was God. I mean, listen, it's one thing to tell a lie. It's another thing to die for a lie. And these disciples, these followers of Jesus Christ, they not only said that he was God, they not only said that he was God come to dwell among people, but they were willing to die for that belief because 10 of the 11, Judas committed suicide, that left 11, 10 of those 11 died martyr's death. And they could have probably saved their lives if they would have renounced all the things they were saying about Jesus. But they gave their lives instead of renounce what they believe. Now, it's one thing to tell a lie. It's another thing to die for something that you know is a lie. Yet these disciples, these Jewish men who lived with him for 3 years, when the time came, they gave their lives because they believed that he was God in flesh. Jesus was God, and he was God with. He was God with. I think a lot of the Old Testament characters would have stuttered at that. Pardon me. I mean, they would have been amazed by the fact that it was God with. In the Old Testament, you had God, but there wasn't a withness to God. Every time God appeared, he appeared as untouchable. He appeared to Abraham in a flame of fire. He appeared to the children of Israel in a pillar of fire. He appeared to Moses in fire. He appeared to Job in a tornado. All of those things are very fearful. They all say, stay away. You can't get close. I mean, fires, tornadoes, those are very scary things. I remember living in Indiana. I went to college for 3 years and I didn't know anything about the siren going off if there was a tornado watch. And so I'm in town and the siren goes off. It sounds like the Nazis are invading, you know. I watch all those World War II movies. It sounds like Britain, you know, and London. And I assume that the siren goes off when they see a tornado, not before. That's a mistake, but the siren went off quite frequently. But I mean, the siren goes off. I'm running to the basement. Two guys live together. We don't clean upstairs. We don't certainly clean the basement. And I jump in this closet, cobwebs all over me. I'm huddled for 5 minutes. I mean, stuff, creepy crawlies. And I'm just, it's like, oh, well, that was it. And then, you know, I keep waiting for the freight train. They say a tornado sounds like a freight train. Nothing happened. I come out, you know, and I don't know what I got all over me, but I mean, it's a fearful thing, a tornado. And Jesus, God would come in a tornado. He would come in a fire. He would come in an earthquake. It was not God with. It was you're over here and God is here. But how does God come in Jesus? He comes as a baby. Not as a fire, not as a flood, not as a earthquake, not as a wind. But he comes as a little baby. There's nothing more touchable than a baby. There's nothing that is more easily grasped, nothing more accessible than a little child. Even if they don't like you, they can't get away from you. I mean, And that's the way God came. He was God with us. What does it mean to have God with us? One of the things that God with us almost certainly means is that because he was God with us, he is able to uniquely identify and to empathize with us. He was God with us. He came, his means of his birth were difficult. His parents had to flee. He lived a life that was at best middle class. When he grew up, he didn't have a lot. He didn't have a home. He never was married. He never had children. He died at the age of 33. His life was one of sorrow. His life was one of pain. Because he was God with us, he can empathize. He can feel your pain. I know Bill Clinton says he can, but he can't do it like Jesus can. he can feel your pain. I mean, listen, many of us have been sheltered in our lives. And we're here in the church, but we had nice families, and our parents were good parents. We can't empathize. We can't feel the pain of a broken family. We don't know what it's like to be rejected by our parents. We don't know what it is like to be physically abused. But Jesus was beaten. He was bloodied. He was torn to shreds by the Roman whips. He knows what it's like to be abused. He knows what it's like to be beaten to death. He knows what it's like to be forsaken by his father. He knows what it's like to be forsaken by his family. He knows what it's like to be run out of his hometown. He knows what that's like because he was God with us. Others of us can't sympathize with all the temptations people go through. I can't sympathize with a person with a drug addiction. I don't know what it's like for my skin to crawl craving something. I don't know what that level of temptation feels like. And that's why I think I'm probably tender towards those who struggle with addictions, because I have no idea how strong an addiction must be. I've seen guys who are bodybuilders. I've seen guys who are in excellent physical shape, that they had great capacity to endure, but they could not endure the cravings of that addiction. And so I can't identify, and many of you can't identify with what that's like. But you know what? Jesus took on the strongest temptation that the universe had to offer. Okay? You and I are tempted by Satan. But no one was tempted more than Satan, than Jesus was. Satan tempted Jesus stronger than anybody else could ever be tempted. He endured temptation beyond the realm that I think you and I could endure it. I mean, William Barclay, the great commentator, says that that Jesus endured stronger temptation from Satan because he didn't cave. He said it's like a five-year-old wrestling their father. And the five-year-old never gets the greatest fight, the strongest fight from their father. I mean, the father never gives him his best fight. He's 5 years old. He couldn't take it. He'd kill him. And in one sense, we're like that five-year-old. We wrestle with Satan, but we give him far before we get his strongest fight. And even if we are wrestling with him with our strongest fight, Jesus is there to help us. But there is Jesus all along enduring Satan's greatest, fiercest temptation. He knows what it's like to be pushed, and he knows what it's like to have something that you want so badly put in front of you, but he has to say no. God knows how to do that. He can identify. He can empathize. he can even empathize with sin. You say, Jesus can't empathize with guilt. Listen, on the cross, all the sins of the world were put upon him. And God turned his face on him because of those sins. He knows what it's like. And I think all those sins on him, he had to feel the guilt of those sins placed upon him. It wasn't just a sacrificial kind of thing. It wasn't just in name only, but I think that the guilt was placed on him, and for a time he felt the guilt of those sins. He knows what that's like. He knows what it's like to die young. 33 years old. 33 and he died. He knows what that's like. He knows what it's like to have unfulfilled dreams, unfulfilled hopes. You say, Jesus can't identify with me. I'm divorced and all my hopes, all my dreams were in that relationship, and it's over now. My children have walked away from me. All my plans, everything that I thought I would accomplish when I was 18, they're all dashed. They're never going to happen. My hopes and dreams are gone. Jesus can sympathize because the humanness of Jesus, for instance, in Matthew chapter 23, the night before, the day before he was crucified, he sat on the mountain overlooking the city of Jerusalem, and he cries. And he's emotionally torn at that moment. And he looks over the city and he says, if you'd have just come to me, how often I wish that I could have gathered you as a hen gathers her chickens under my wings and protected you and loved you, but you wouldn't let me do it. You just wouldn't let me do it. And so Jesus knows what it's like to want something, to crave something, to desire it so greatly, but it be denied him at the end. I don't understand. I watch these guys lose presidential elections. I cannot imagine what it's like to run for an office for 3 years. And then on one night, you lose and that's it. I can't imagine what that's like. I can't imagine what it's like to have that taken from your grasp. But I think Jesus can. He's God with us. He can identify with where we're at. That's one of the things that it means. And then secondly, and I'm finished. God with us means that you can have a personal relationship with him. He fills you. He understands you. He empathizes with you. And he's with us so that he can have a personal relationship with us. Listen to me. Anything else he wanted to accomplish, he could have done it from heaven. All the teaching, I mean, he could have taken all the teaching and he could have dipped his finger in a cloud and he could have written it across the sky in the clouds. He could have put the message in the stars. If he had come in judgment, he could have done that from heaven. He could have sent the angels to round us all up. Anything that he wanted to have done other than have a relationship with us, he could have done it in heaven. He wouldn't have had to come down here. Am I okay? But he came down here to have a relationship. He came down here, made himself, came in as a child, came in as a baby, came in vulnerable, suffered with us, bled and died so that he could have a relationship with you. Listen, he's accessible to you. He's not somebody that you have to read about in a book. He's somebody that you can know, that you can have a relationship with. And there's a vast difference in those two. Listen, a lot of us know about people, but we don't have a relationship with them. You have a favorite movie star. You know about them. Maybe you know their kids' names. You know their parents' names. You know their wives' names. But you don't have a relationship with them. My brother and I had a favorite singer, and his name was John Pizzarelli. Nobody knows him, but he never did well, but we liked him. And we went to a concert once, and my brother peeked behind the curtain and saw him and waved. And then he came back to me and said, he's back there, why don't you go wave at him? And I went, waved, and you know, that's the closest I ever got to John Pizzarelli. I knew him, I knew all his music, but I didn't have a relationship with him. And God isn't back there behind the curtain anymore. He's not back there behind the stage. He came. He's God with us. And the reason he came, the reason he came to be with us, is because he wants a personal relationship with you. And he can feel your pain. Will you stand with me? There's a passage in Hebrews chapter 4, verse 13. And it says that because Jesus came, because Jesus did all the things that he did, because he died, because he rose again, because he's at the right hand of the Father, it says that we can come boldly to him. And boldly in the Bible doesn't mean forcefully. It doesn't mean loudly. It's not the emphasis of boldly. The Bible boldly simply means plainly. It means to come plainly. To come boldly to somebody means that you come without hypocrisy. You come without hiding anything. You come and you just tell him what you're thinking, what you're honestly feeling, what's really on your heart, what's really on your mind. And it says, because he came to us, we can come to him. He came to us boldly, plainly. As a baby, as a child, we saw him. We saw him in all of his humanness. We saw his deity even veiled by his humanness at times. He came boldly. He came plainly. And you can come plainly to him. You can bring your stuff to him. Listen, he knows, he understands, he cares. There's nothing you've gone through. Now, he hasn't been divorced. He hasn't been through a lot of things, but he knows how it feels to be alienated. He knows how it feels to have his dreams crushed. He knows how it feels to have relationships denied him. And he can understand. Maybe no one else in this room can understand, but he can understand because he was God with us. Maybe there's something you want to bring to him. Listen, if you want to pray by yourself, pray around here. Nobody will get to you. If you want somebody to pray with you, come over here and kneel, and people will surround you. If you have a problem on your heart, a problem on your mind, you just need to talk it through. Come over here, and somebody who knows what they're talking about will come talk to you. Let's sing together.